test the machine. And I also would like to explain to you that you have complete control over the interview. It will be transcribed, but only if the final product will only be with your approval. So you can be completely candid, and if you don't like something you said,
sometimes
you can take,
you
can ask,
you
right?
Like,
or I may,
it
sounds different, or I may ask you a question that you don't like, and we,
okay.
You can always ask that
but
it be
do you want
edited.
To publish it? What will be
I don't
the final
know.
Result
I don't. It's not. No, the final result will be that we put it into the archives as the oral. It's an oral history project, which the Center for the History of Chemistry is doing and organizing. And I also brought you our first newsletter.
Oh, yeah.
And so you can keep that, and that shows you a little bit of what the purpose of the center is, and this is part.
Charlie Price still around?
Yes, Charlie Price, Dr. Price. Well, I don't see him too often, but
he's now retired.
He's retired, but he says he's busier than ever, just like you probably will say. And he was on the policy council. I was on the first policy council of the center, and he was the chairman of the policy council. So I met him several times.
Thank you very much. I like that. I have been
keep
in
that.
There in Philadelphia 15 years ago.
Yes.
Charlie was still the chair.
I cannot adjust the mic or
But I think if we speak both in the same direction,
it might be much better.
Now perhaps you ask questions.
Yes, I will. I will. I just want to listen to this once more. This is Tonya Kopel interviewing Professor Vladimir Prelog in his office at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich, Switzerland on January 17, 1984. Professor Prelog, you were born on the 23rd of July, 1906, in Zagreb, which was then what?
No.
You were not born in Zagreb.
I was not born in Zagreb. I was
no, in Sarajevo.
In Sarajevo.
That's right.
Which is the capital, which was at that time the capital of Bosnia and Herzegovina, which was province of Austrian-Hungarian monarchy. And in many respects that influenced my life, the place where I was born, because it has a rather bad reputation. In 1940, Archduke and his wife were assassinated there, and that is considered to be the direct reason for the First World War.
Yes, I read that in my history books.
Realized that when I had to take sailing permit in 1950, I think, in the United States. Mm-hmm. And then I was interviewed by an income tax man, and he asked me, Professor, where are you from?
Yes.
And I said, Zurich.
Yes.
So he said, Zurich, Sweden. I said, no, Zurich, Switzerland.
Yes.
So he was a little irritated.
Uh-huh.
So he said to me, but you were not born, of course, in Zurich. I said, no. So he said, where?
Yes.
And I answered, Sarajevo. And he said, ah, that's the place where all this mess started. So. And I was very proud that he didn't know that Zurich is in Switzerland, uh-huh. but he knew that Sarajevo exists when I was born.
Well, he didn't hold it against you, did he?
No.
And that was in 1950.
That was in 1950.
Yes, that.
So it is now a famous place because this year, I think, the Winter Olympiad will be held in Sarajevo.
Yes.
So
mm-hmm.
it has now much publicity.
Very good. Well, then you went to school in Sarajevo. You must have been in school when this happened.
When?
About
yes,
8 years old?
I was in the elementary school,
yes.
and I was really very near to the place of assassination. As a pupil, I had to throw flowers.
Mm-hmm.
I was in the first row and had to throw flowers
before
the carriage of the Archduke. And that I did, and about 200 meters after the place where I was located, he was assassinated.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't see anything. It was behind the corner.
But it must have been traumatic.
But it was very dramatic.
Big confusion, I guess.
I was, as in many other cases, a spectator of very important events.
Yes. Oh, yes, you were indeed. Two world wars. But we'll get to this later. So you went through grade school?
Through the elementary school, and then we moved into another place, Zagreb.
That's where I got this.
So you get the impression. The greatest part of my life in Yugoslavia I spent in the city of Zagreb, which is the capital of Croatia, of the northern part of Yugoslavia.
What year did you move to Zagreb?
In 1915.
So you were still in grade school then, about grade 3. And then you got into a new school, and then...
And then I took what we call Real Gymnasium.
Yes.
That's a kind of...
What?
Something between elementary school and high school.
It's
practically the same as in Switzerland.
But it is not up to university level.
It goes altogether 8 years.
Eight years,
and then you get what we call maturity examination.
Yes, yes.
This is a condition to go to a university, to be accepted by a university.
Mm-hmm.
This is a European, more or less, middle European system of
schooling. And you must have had chemistry there, because I noticed that you published a paper while still
I spent
school.
2 years in a smaller town, Osijek, because my father was appointed director of, again, such a high school. And so I spent 2 years in Osijek, and there I had a very, very good teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And I helped him in his endeavors to build up a small laboratory for teaching high school students. And there I constructed a small apparatus, and as I mentioned on several occasions, it shows that the level of chemical literature was not very high, because my paper was accepted and it was published when I was about 15 years old.
Oh, that's wonderful. What was the name of the paper?
It was about a titration apparatus.
Yes, eine Trierfortrichtung in German. So you wrote it actually in German.
I wrote it in German. That was corrected by my teacher and was accepted by the chemical side, which was an acceptable German.
But then you were already bilingual. Your mother's language was Croatian.
No, I could write. We had German in school.
But
mother tongue was Croatian.
Croatian.
And, we didn't speak at home German.
I see.
But we read. In our family, there many German books and so on, but we didn't speak.
Huh? Yes, yes. Well, that's what was the name of your father? What was his first name?
My father's name was Milan.
Milan.
Yeah, that's Milan. A Yugoslav name.
Yes.
He was first professor at a gymnasium, as we call it, which means something different from American meaning of this word. That means that's a kind of high school. Huh?
Yes, but that was not the same as Oberrealschule. Your Oberrealschule was Sekundarschule, or?
That is a combination between a Sekundarschule and a gymnasium.
I see.
You could have different, different. There were different branches. In one of the branches, Greek and Latin was emphasized strongly. Mm-hmm. That means that people who wanted to become lawyers or even medical people had to take Greek and Latin as one of the directions. And in the other, more mathematics, natural sciences, and so on. That was called Real Gymnasium.
I see.
So I have taken this more scientific education, not humanities.
But your father was not a scientist.
My father was a historian.
A historian.
Very soon he became professor at the University of History at the University of Zagreb.
Then
we moved again back to Zagreb, and the last years of my schooling at this level was in Zagreb.
Did it have any influence on you that you seem to have a somewhat historical bent in, at least in your latest?
Yeah, I come from a family of historians. Even my grandfather was historian, and my father was historian.
Mm-hmm.
I have a brother who is a historian, mm-hmm. and my son is a historian.
Oh, well,
he's at the University of Marburg now.
So how did you get to be a chemist? Your mother scientific in any way? Well, did she have
a
science education?
I was very much interested in science, and I think happens always, perhaps as a kind of protest against my father.
Yes, that could very well be. That happens very often. So you then moved to Prague to study. And you studied chemistry, engineering chemistry?
Yes. At that time, engineering it was very different from it's understood today. Technology, really.
It was
a chemical technology. It was an institute of technology in Prague. It was called their technical high school, as many other schools in Germany. But that had a status of a university status. That was not a high school.
No.
Technische Hochschule, Eidgenössische Technische Hochschule, I think it's translated, the best translation is Institute of Technology.
Yes, like MIT,
like
Massachusetts,
or Caltech.
Or like the Swiss Federal Institute of
Technology.
That's a misunderstanding.
And that was a school, it was called the School of Chemical Engineering. But it was not the engineering as it is taught today. That means very strong emphasis of apparatus and technical processes. It was more or less a descriptive technology. We had pure science and descriptive technology, as it was for a long time also here in Zurich.
Mm-hmm.
It was not chemical engineering, really, what we taught here.
That's true, yes.
It was more or less chemical technology.
Yes, I remember that in my own time when I was here. So, in Prague, I read in one of your last publications, or it was actually, I think it was a talk, a lecture.
Yeah, it was a lecture at the University of Marburg.
Gedanken nach 118 Semestern Chemiestudium, which we should translate with what? Memories or thoughts after 118 semesters.
Yeah, semester doesn't exist, I think, in American schools.
Yes,
some of them.
Semesters.
Mostly they are trimesters. So.
Oh, yes, in a way you're right. There are many universities go on trimesters, but the conventional way is still semester.
So it means 59 years now, which is almost 60 years.
Have you
years.
Been...
I have first, since I started,
right.
At the Institute of Technology in Prague.
What you want to say is that you were a teacher as well as a student.
Yeah, I'm all the time a student.
Right.
Temporarily, I was already... I was also a teacher. But I feel more like a student.
Well, that's the best. What I want to say is that you mentioned here that you were not too happy in your first year of chemistry because there was a certain philosophical depth that was lacking.
Yes,
is that true?
I found, I thought that it will be something very exciting, very deep, and this daily work was rather dull, to determine. I really knew about all these things.
I see.
So it was to me dull, I must say, to determine iron in a mixture of iron, cobalt, and whatever it was, qualitatively or quantitative analysis. That was to me all something which I didn't think I will have to learn at the university. But then I found a young assistant who helped me, who showed me how one can do science, and that was organic chemistry, which I considered at the beginning as something, I would say, very empirical. And I didn't like, I liked to see some generalities. I thought the science, so I thought that one has first to learn very general things and go into details from very general standpoint. But later I learned that it's much easier, or that a better approach to start with special things and try to develop it into something more general. And that's what I learned from Lukács, who was at that time not much older than myself, but much more advanced in his knowledge of organic chemistry. That was very important for all my development, that he taught me how wonderful really organic chemistry is and how wonderfully organized it is and how easy it is really to start scientific work in organic chemistry, because it's relatively easy to get out of the known into the unknown. If you like to make some general concepts and so on, of course, for a beginner it's extremely difficult, or he must be very, very ingenious or very talented
on. Yes, indeed. You took the conventional courses, I assume. You started with general chemistry, and what else did you take? Physics? Or
We had quite a lot of technology, but that I did very superficially, with great success, but very superficially.
Yes.
I was only interested in organic chemistry when I became acquainted
with it.
I did all these other things very routinely.
Or reluctantly.
I couldn't do it reluctantly because I had very little money, so I had to do it very, very fast.
I see.
I finished my studies in the shortest legally possible time.
Which was how many semesters?
Eight semesters. I had already my PhD thesis at that time ready.
Oh, yes.
But I had to, it was a law that you can make your PhD examination only 2 semesters after your diploma. So I had to wait, really. I was already employed when I did my PhD examination.
I see. So you...
I finished my studies in 9 semesters with the degree of doctor engineer, which was first to get an engineer's diploma. It was similar like here. Mm-hmm. And then after that, if you make your doctor examination, you become a doctor engineer.
Yes. And what was the topic of your dissertation?
It was a constitution of a natural product, which was called rhamnoconvolvulic acid, which was an aglycone of a glycoside. PhD sponsor or advisor was Emil Watercheck, who was a sugar chemist at that time, well-known sugar chemist. Mm-hmm. He was a pupil of the famous German sugar chemist Bernhard Tollens.
Oh yes, I see.
Tollens test. Uh-huh. And but I didn't like sugar chemistry.
Why not?
At that time, in some way, the sugar chemistry reached a certain stage where it didn't develop. It was only routine work which was done about sugar chemistry at that time in our laboratory.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So I asked for something, for a natural compound, but not a sugar.
Not a sugar.
And that was a more or less a byproduct of a hydrolytic product, an aglycone of a glycoside, which was investigated. Mm-hmm. So I determined the structure in a relatively short time. It was a small piece of work, but a good one.
Yes. Well, it seems to have brought you into one of your main fields, namely natural products.
Yes, I became
analysis and synthesis.
An addict of natural product chemistry. And I stayed it all my life.
Yes.
The other thing which I did had always a certain connection with the natural product chemistry. Natural product chemistry was always a starting point. If I deviated, it was always a starting point, was always some problem in connection with natural products.
But it did get you into stereochemistry, didn't it?
Yeah, because if you deal with natural products, you have stereochemistry is not a special science, it's a way of looking chemistry.
Yes.
So if you work on natural products, you have you more or less find that there are always stereochemical problems, configurations, conformations, to understand what happens, to understand the reaction mechanisms, you have to consider stereochemistry. So all stereochemical problems more or less were the result of our work on natural products.
Yeah, I want to ask you many more questions about stereochemistry, but I would like to maybe ask you what you did next. You went into industry, didn't you?
Yeah, well, I mentioned it in my talk here in 1929. That was a time of great crisis, economic crisis in the United States as well as in Europe. Mm-hmm. There were many unemployed people in Czechoslovakia, And I was a foreigner there, and it was no place for me at an academic institution or any other institution where I could do research in chemistry, which I wanted to do. So I was very happy when a place was offered by me again by a friend of my colleague or my mentor, I would say, Lukas, who was really a merchant. He was also a chemist, but he had two shops with chemicals and chemical apparatus. And he very often needed some compounds which were not at that time available commercially. So he wanted me to organize a small laboratory where we could make compounds which are not commercially available, something like a beginning of an Aldrich company or Fluka company at a very small scale at that time, at a very modest scale. So we did that. We organized, he bought a small house, we rebuilt it into a laboratory, we bought some books and apparatus from his shops.
And
so we started to prepare chemicals, rare chemicals. Our customers were, for example, some military research laboratories. I prepared a number of toxic compounds which these people wanted to test for military purposes. Mm-hmm. And many other small things. If some product was not commercially available but became interesting for somebody, for example, we prepared as a joke a great quantities of ammonium sulfite.
Sulfite.
Yes. Which was used for permanent waves, which was not at that time commercially available, or at least it was expensive. And we prepared large quantities of chloroacetophenone. For police. It was also at that time not available everywhere.
For police? What
yes,
was that?
Yes, that is a, what is a lacrimatory gas?
Oh,
which is
I
used.
See.
That is the most
oh, it's
usual.
A lacrimator.
It's a lacrimator.
And
many other such things. But I had also opportunity, we had a small analytical laboratory, and I could also do in the evening some research. And especially I was stimulated by my boss, who desired to become, to get a doctor's degree. So he also worked in the evening.
He didn't have it yet.
No.
That was Lukas.
Lukas. He was his friend, but he had only engineer's degree. And he wanted to become become a doctor. So he was my first PhD student. And it was a little, I would say, a funny situation to be an employee. And your employer is your PhD candidate. But he was a very nice person, so it worked very well. He was not much older than me. He was only about 10 years older than I was. So he did his PhD degree summa cum laude.
It was quite successful.
Yeah, so I was successful with my first
PhD candidate.
With your first
student. Were you careful with your toxic chemicals? I've read over and over again about the dire consequences that great chemists were poisoned at an early age because there was not enough ventilation or
When I think now of what we did then...
You didn't think so, no.
It is terrible, you know.
But you seem to have survived it.
More or less, we worked under criminal conditions.
And no,
we
did, no fume hoods?
Oh, yeah.
You did have good ventilation.
We get, but we prepared, let us say, such strong carcinogenics as nitrosourea in kilos, without even using gloves. I remember that I myself prepared and filtered it on a big Büchner funnel with bare hands.
Bare hands, and
so we prepared liters of ethereal diazomethane solutions, which somebody wanted.
Yes.
We prepared all kinds of arsenicals and things like that. We prepared derivatives of tellurium and things like that, selenium.
Sounds dreadful.
Sounds dreadful, and still I'm now over 77.
Yes, well, that's the secret of...
That's a problem. That's this problem of carcinogenicity is a very special problem.
Yes, yes.
And I wouldn't recommend anybody to do what we did.
No, don't tempt fate.
I'm now very, very careful that my co-workers don't do such things.
Yes.
But at that time we didn't know. That was a time when the first carcinogens were really discovered. Carcinogenicity didn't exist in the terminology of chemistry. This was this first compound like benzpyrene and similar compounds from tar, coal tar, which were discovered in England. But still, most of the, we didn't know anything about carcinogenicity of the other.
Chemicals that are carcinogens, and how careless it was done at that time. And so you did publish quite a few papers in during your industrial period.
Yes, not so many, but I wanted to do some work besides of this daily work which I had to do some research, and so we picked up as a subject a synthesis of sinhona alkaloids like quinine and similar things. And at that time the constitution of quinine was known but not the configuration, and there was no synthesis of quinine itself, only of dihydroquinine. But the starting material was not easily available, so we wanted to eradicate malaria, what we wanted. We wanted to do something socially relevant.
Yes, yes.
It was necessary to find a new cheap method which can be done on which can be used on big scale to produce one of the half of the quinine or the corresponding other alkaloids. And we spent several years on that problem. We didn't solve it completely, but only partially. I continued with that when I left Prague. At a certain moment, I found that I want badly to have an academic position. And then from my country, from Yugoslavia, from the University of Zagreb, I got an offer. I really was appointed what they called a university docent, and that was a position with the duties of a full professor and with the salary of the poorly paid assistant, which I didn't know, I didn't realize that. But I accepted the position and I moved from Prague to Zagreb to the university, when I spent 5 years continuing really the work I started already in Prague. With a few young people, I was able to organize a laboratory, and with the help of a small financial help of a small pharmaceutical factory, oh, we did quite well for the time being, until the 41, when Yugoslavia was occupied by German army. So I found that I will get into troubles and that I have to emigrate, and I could do it more or less in a relatively simply, because I got an invitation by Professor Richard Kuhn from Germany. He was the, at that time, president of the German Chemical Society, and he invited me to come to Germany to give talks about my work.
Yes.
With this invitation, I visited German occupation general of the German occupation army, which was in charge of Zagreb, and he gave an order to the independent state of Croatia to issue me 2 passports, and my predecessor here, Professor Ružička, who was my former countryman, invited me to visit him in Switzerland, and with his invitation I got a Swiss visa. And so I came legally in Switzerland without any heroic attempts to climb mountains,
yes,
and to be refused, to be refused by the frontiers.
Yes, yes.
And I came here, I would say, at the right time. Professor Ružička had a number of older co-workers and assistants who were emigrants in Switzerland and who didn't feel safe in Switzerland, and emigrated. Most of them left for United States in time, in just about few weeks or 1 week, yes, even before I arrived.
I see. So there were a lot of vacancies here.
There was lots of vacancies for an older chemist, and so I started here as a student, became then the so-called private docent, and then I went through all stages of academic hierarchy. I was a titular professor, which means with a title but without a salary.
Oh.
Then I became an associate professor,
yes,
a personal full professor, and later I succeeded Ružička as the chairman of the organic chemistry laboratory, and I retired in 76. That was my career here, and now I'm a student again.
Well, you moved up very fast the ladder.
Yes, but that is only just a summary of my career,
yes,
in Zurich.
Yes,
that means,
yes,
I arrived here and I was then just a co-worker of Professor,
yes,
Ružička.
And then you moved up.
And then
very
I was
quickly
assistant also, yes, here, and then I moved slowly.
Yeah, but within just a few
climbing
years.
Climbing the hierarchical ladder.
Yes, yes, of course.
And,
you were in Switzerland before once, weren't you?
I was about
Professor
4 months as a kind of postdoc. I was never before in a big laboratory.
Yes.
So in 1937, where I collected some money from my cooperation with the small industry in Zagreb, I used this money to spend here 4 months in the laboratory of Professor Ružička. So Ružička knew me.
I see. Well,
so he knew that perhaps I shall be a good co-worker, and
yes,
that more or less facilitated my my emigration to
that
Switzerland.
That proved to be very advantageous. So you came to the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology, and what did you find here? I mean, I know it was very peaceful in Switzerland during the war, so everybody who came in from war-torn countries found it very peaceful. How,
yes,
how was the working climate? What?
Oh, it was very good. You know, we had our, especially our house, they were mostly Swiss here. We didn't have practically foreigners. At that time, the Swiss had to do their military service on the frontiers.
Yes.
But just because of that, they were very eager also to work hard, you know. They spent always a part of time doing military service and coming back and working on their PhD thesis. Mm-hmm. I think the atmosphere was very good. We were cut off from the world chemical literature. We got only very seldom a number of a journal of American Chemical Society.
Oh,
or
I see.
We, even from Germany, the mail didn't function well. Sometimes the journals were very often lost. But we could concentrate and work on problems where we didn't have to read so much, but to work hard. So it was altogether pleasant, of course. We were never sure that the Germans will not occupy Switzerland.
Yes, I remember
there were certain
that.
Situations in which situation was very hot.
Yes.
But compared, when you were once already occupied by Germans, so it was not so bad.
You were not too afraid that they would invade Switzerland.
No,
I know there was a time when they
everybody
almost debated whether they should go through
and
Switzerland
never knew
or through
because,
Holland
because
to attack.
Hitler was more or less a madman.
Yes, of course.
You couldn't depend that he will make a rational decision. He could make a completely irrational decision.
Yes, that was true. You had your own journal then here. Did that just get started, the Helvetica Chimica Acta, or was that in existence?
Helvetica Chimica Acta started after the First World War.
Oh, I see. So that was not the impetus to start
the
journal.
We had our own journal. We could publish,
publish quickly. Most of it right here.
We published everything
Helvetica.
During that time when I was here.
Yes.
I published before in Czech or even in German journals, in Berichte der Deutschen Chemischen Gesellschaft in Annalen, but it was much nicer to publish it in Helvetica. So practically everything I did at that time, and later, only occasionally I published in foreign journals. We published most of our experimental work in Helvetica Chimica Acta. That was a tradition, and that made Helvetica Chimica Acta a respectable journal.
Yes.
A number of very good chemists like Karrer, Ružička, Reichstein, and many others published all their important work in Helvetica Chimica Acta. Especially the Helvetica were famous because of the work on natural products.
Natural products,
which was here the main topics in which was.
Were you on the editorial board or
no? I was never on the editorial board of
Helvetica
Chimica Acta. I was for some time a member of the committee of the Swiss Chemical Society, and I was for 2 years also president of the Chemical Society. But I was not on the a member of the board.
So
I wouldn't be also good because I am not a great linguist and so on and. I think it was wise not to appoint me in the editorial board. By the way, at that time, The Helvetica Chimica Acta were more or less edited by the chief editor, and the editorial board had only very little function, just in some dubious cases to strengthen, so to say, the chief editor in his decision.
I see. And the chief editor was
the chief here. Editor was first Professor Fichter in Basel for many years, and he was succeeded by Professor Cherbulier in Geneva.
Professor Cherbulier in Geneva? Was he
for
a chemist?
Years, he was a chemist.
I just
professor of organic chemistry in Geneva, and he was an extreme. Both of these editors were very competent.
Yes.
And so we were famous. We could publish very quickly. Because our papers were not refereed, only in the case of doubt.
I see.
Because everybody knew everybody, so everybody was responsible for himself.
I see.
So it was easy to publish rapidly, mm-hmm. and I think also the journal had a certain standard.
So the Swiss Chemical Society played a large role, or was it, were most chemists members, or?
I think everybody who was working in research, either in academia or in industry,
yes,
was a member of
the Swiss Chemical Society.
It was not a professional society, it was purely scientific society.
It remained a scientific society
until now.
It still is not a professional society.
Yes. It doesn't care about salaries and status of chemists and their
employment.
Not like
the American
Chemical Society. Or now even English Chemical Society.
I see.
Which is the Royal Chemical Society.
When you started your work here, you were right again with natural products. I guess under the influence of Professor Ruschitzka, Leopold Ruschitzka. Did you work
when I came
directly
here,
with him?
We of course discussed what I should do. Hmm?
Yes.
So there was here a, I would say, an area which was abandoned by this chemist who left Switzerland. I must tell you that some of these chemists became later very famous in the United States.
Huh? Could you name them?
Yes, of course. One of them was Dr. Sternbach, who was a Polish Jew.
Yes.
And who, as you know, is discoverer of Librium and Valium, which changed in some ways the medicine of chemistry.
Yes, that's in Nutley.
He was with Hoffmann-La Roche, when he left, he was already employed by Hoffmann-La Roche. Mm-hmm. And so in Nutley he discovered then Librium and Valium.
Yes.
That changed very much the medicine of chemistry.
Yes, indeed.
The second one, which was Dr. Rosenkranz, who became later the president of the Syntex Company in Mexico. Mm-hmm. And he made Syntex a worldwide known company. They were responsible for the pill, to a great extent.
Oh,
and so on. So
I never realized that the pill came from Mexico.
You see, in Mexico there was this, they had these steroids, which are starting material for preparing the pill at that time. Mm-hmm. So it was just the right place to develop that.
Yes.
They were not the only people, but they were at the end practically the most important people.
Mm-hmm. What was the name of the product, the commercial name?
I don't know.
You don't know.
They changed all the time this name because the pill didn't develop at once.
I see.
They
yes.
So I had first, Ruzhichka at that time bought a large amount of organ extracts from the United States, from large quantities of lipoids from organs. And he hoped that by a modern method it will be possible to isolate some new hormones or some new compounds with high biological activity. And this work remained here, and I had to continue in cooperation with Ruzhichka on one side. And on the other side, he said, you could do any work on natural product or any other work you want, but you have to continue that. So I had two, and you will get few co-workers. So perhaps you yourself should work on organ extracts, and your co-workers will work, for example, on alkaloid chemistry. I was still interested. From the very beginning, I was interested in exciting structures of alkaloids. At that time, they were very unusual. Today, this is not anymore. So all these structures seem to us very common. But at that time, they looked very exciting and unusual compared with other natural products. So I worked on organ extracts, and at the same time I worked on alkaloids.
Was it?
These few co-workers, which were more or less given to me by Ruzhichka, assigned to me by Ruzhichka.
So then you published a few papers on...
With Ruzhichka, on organ extracts. We really were disappointed by this work on organ extracts.
In spite
of hard work, on hard work, we didn't find anything really spectacular.
And you got only small amounts, I suppose.
Yes, and there was nothing very new. The only thing we really discovered were a musk odors from testes of boars. And that's an interesting story. I already have forgotten that that I myself, with my own hands, isolated these compounds. Then they became in some way famous. They are sex attractants for swine. So they are used in animal husbandry.
Yes.
On one side. It's also another discovery is very interesting. Do you say truffles. They are detected by swine. They are under the soil.
Yes.
And
yes.
They use swine to find them.
Yes.
And that's because they contain this compound, this musk-like, musk smelling, like smelling steroid, androstenol. So they are really searching for this sex attractant. And
to get
that's
their food.
One point, and then they claim that also that attracts also females, and they are sold.
That's why it's used. A lot of perfumes contain musk oil, right? It was a big ado about musk oil for a few years ago.
Anyway, but that was really a very small discovery. I mention it only because. We at that time didn't have the slightest idea. We are very attractive to ladies when we work.
I didn't think so. I have to tell you, I worked next to a student. It must have been one of your students, and he worked with musk day in, day out, and I couldn't stand the smell anymore.
He
smelled everything. Around him smelled of musk.
Yeah, but it is so that you know that is really it must be extremely diluted.
Yes, I know that.
And immediately
otherwise
when
it's
you
offensive.
Otherwise it is,
it was
it
awful.
Is rather irritating.
It was awful, but he must have worked for you. So you stayed really with natural
Yes, and then we started to work on alkaloids. We continued a little work on configuration of Sinhona alkaloids. Then we started to work on strychnine, and we corrected Robinson's strychnine formula wrongly. That means we showed that the Robinson's formula is wrong.
Yes.
But we didn't ourselves propose a good formula.
I see.
But that slowly then we continued. Professor Woodworth also came into the picture. And finally the formula of strychnine was perfect.
Elucidated
completely. Yes. And that was at that time a relatively great achievement.
It was heroic, as you say.
Because with chemical methods, it was not so easy to determine a structure of such polycyclic alkaloids.
Yes, I understand.
And it was considered. We really worked on it because we didn't have any other alkaloids at our disposition, and found in our store a bottle with 5 kilos of strychnine. So somebody bought, I don't know for what purposes,
rat poison or
whatever it was. So I then read about 140 papers by Loix in Germany, in Berlin, about 50 papers by Sir Robert Robinson, 50 papers by Sir Robert Robinson, about 30 papers by Heinrich Wieland. We didn't have any other literature to read, so it was possible at that time to spend quite a lot of time in library reading old papers. And then we were very lucky by our first experiments. We found that it is something wrong with Robinson's formula, which was considered to be correct for a dozen of years. And that made us in some way famous, because Robinson was considered at that time perhaps the best chemist of the world, and that we could more or less find a mistake or something wrong with his formula.
What was wrong with his formula? What did he show? What kind of formula did he show? What was wrong with his formula?
Oh, you know, the size of the rings was not so easily. So he had a six-membered ring.
Bridged atoms were not in place,
He put on the place of a six-membered ring a five-membered ring.
I see.
So that was our first discovery that this ring can't be a five-membered ring.
Well, you already had a lot of experience with
polycyclic compounds,
like you synthesized adamantane.
Yes, that was more or less a sideline.
The constitution also of adamantane.
No. Constitution was we synthesized. We had the first synthesis of adamantane, which was also a proof of constitution, because. Of course, the constitution of adamantane was known, but it was more or less a matter of intuition, and it was not proven. It was also an X-ray, but at that time it was a Debye-Scherer X-ray diagram, which didn't prove really the position, the position of atoms. It showed only that the proposed formula was compatible. With the X-rays.
Was it two-dimensional then?
Lukács was the first man who proposed the right formula, but more or less intuitively, because of the crystals of adamantane, which were tetrahedral. It was a hydrocarbon C10 H16 with a melting point of about 280 degrees, which is quite unusual for such a small molecule. It's only possible because it is almost perfectly spherical and it fits very well the lattice, the crystal lattice.
Yes.
That was one point, and the other point was the tetrahedral crystal structure. form. Mm-hmm. And from that, by intuition, he said that can be only such a highly symmetrical hydrocarbon. Mm-hmm. But then, of course, they made so-called powder diagram. Mm-hmm. It means you don't get the positions of the individual atoms in
galaxies.
For that, you need to have something more. And that was, of course, compatible. It had to be compatible with this formula if it was right. But our synthesis was the structure proof, synthetic structure proof of the correctness of Adam and Tan formula. We did only two papers on all that. Mm-hmm. And, but at that time, it made some impression on our...
Yeah, that was before you came to Zurich. That was in 1941.
That was already in Zagreb.
Could you tell me a little bit about Woodward? You mentioned published several papers with him, and
Woodward came here first time in 1948. Mm-hmm. I would say he was supported by the so-called Swiss American Foundation, which was founded by Swiss by the American branches of Swiss firms at the beginning after the war. It was a little contact, not so much contact, between Swiss and American chemists. Mm-hmm. And to promote this contact, they sent every year fellows here, and one of these first fellows was Professor Woodward, who was at that time not accepted by American chemical establishment from different reasons. And so he came here, and
do you know the reasons?
Yes, but I don't want to talk. Woodward was very young.
How young was he?
Well, at that time I would have to calculate 1748, that was 31 years. But he had some conflicts with the older people, especially among the American chemists, because he was very self-confident, if not arrogant. He knew that he knows much more chemistry than these people, and so on, and he irritated them. Mm-hmm. Some of them, of course, recognized him, but the others just thought that his personal properties are not, that he's not a pleasant fellow. And Ruzicka, my predecessor, who was at that time a Nobel Prize winner, accepted him fully. He recognized that he is a really great man, and of course I accepted him immediately, and so we became very good friends already during his first stay here in Switzerland, and this friendship remained until his premature death. He was 62 a few years ago.
Was he here 1 year or...?
No. He was here only for a lecture
for a short time, about
a few days.
Just a few days.
But during these few days,
then,
he was already at Harvard.
Yes.
But he was, I think, at that time only associate professor. He became then soon promoted. We really thought that he would be a very good addition to our staff.
Well,
he considered it, very strongly, but then he became so famous and
his relationship with you and ETH, and what about the Woodward Institute?
So when he became so famous, we were not able to offer him a position. He didn't have at Harvard any teaching duties, at least teaching duties. He didn't want. If he didn't want to teach, he was not...
He didn't have to.
He didn't have to. And it would be impossible to have here a professor without teaching duties, so to say.
Yes, yes, I imagine.
As they have in Harvard. But he still thought always to bind him stronger to Switzerland. So finally, I persuaded SIBA Company to organize an institute in Basel in which he could do whatever he wanted, with the idea that if the result have some practical value, they will be used by SIBA Company, and if not, it will be a good chemistry. So the institute, the Woodward Institute, was organized in Basel, in the area of SIBA Company. He had a laboratory with about six co-workers, with a kind of lieutenant who would lead the research during his absence.
Who was that?
There were several of them. Dr. Häusler, for example.
Yes.
And then later he was replaced by Dr. Ernst, and mm-hmm. later replaced by Dr. Kosteli. There were mm-hmm. three of them who
I
were more or less who were chemists of SIBA Company and more or less given
the
position temporarily.
On loan to the institute.
To Woodward. They stayed members of the employees of the SIBA Company, but were so to say on loan to Woodward.
Yes,
Institute.
Yes. But what was the cooperation between, or the relationship between the Woodward Institute and the ETH, the Swiss Federal Institute?
No.
How about vitamin B12 when Eschenmoser and
That was completely independent. Nothing was done on vitamin B12 in Woodward Institute in Basel.
Oh, it wasn't?
That was all done at Harvard.
Oh, I see.
And during these many visits of Professor Woodward, Professor Eschenmoser decided to also to work on B12 almost at the same time when Woodward did it. He knew that Woodward is doing that, but mm-hmm. he was not afraid. Mm-hmm. And finally they started independently, and slowly they came. The task was so difficult and so time consuming that they decided that each of these two groups will do their work on a certain part of vitamin B12, and then they, at the end, they united, they exchanged experience, they exchanged results, even compounds. So it was a very, very close cooperation in which each of these people contributed his own share, and finally each was crowned by the success. That was considered by a German chemist, said that's Mount Everest of synthetic age.
Piece of work.
But that didn't have anything to do with the Woodward Institute in Basel.
Oh, I see.
They never touched anything which in connection with
vitamin B12. So
that was done either in Zurich by a group of Professor Eschenmoser, or at Harvard by Professor Woodward.
I see.
It was also a problem which didn't have any practical importance, because it is so clear that it will not be possible to use that for synthesis. Vitamin B12 can be produced so cheaply from microbial cultures that this, all these difficulties, it would never be, or you should never say never, but at least we can't now think that a synthesis would be, let us say, really a source
of vitamin B.
Yes.
Yes. Well, I really would like to ask you about stereochemistry. You received the Nobel Prize for your contribution to the stereochemistry of organic molecules and for reactions involving stereospecific pathways, and that was in 1975, and I would really be interested knowing how you started to become so involved into
you see the work on alkaloids all these structures have a number of what was called asymmetric carbon atoms or asymmetric atoms at all, and it's mostly so that each of these natural compounds has a number of these asymmetric centers or asymmetric atoms, which leads then to a number of stereoisomers.
Yes.
And it was necessary first to specify the stereoisomer you have in mind.
Yes.
If you have a number, let us say, 64 stereoisomers, and only one is a natural compound, and only one is biologically active, so you have, in some way, to have an opportunity first to represent this molecule by a model or by a stereo formula. Secondly, you have to have a certain language to speak, and then you have to have a method to prepare this specific stereoisomer. So these are all problems which at that time were not solved, or were only very, I would say, poorly solved. And during our work we had the need, we needed a language to talk about our results. And so slowly all the interest in stereochemistry became always stronger and stronger. And it started, let us say, with the determination of configuration of synhona alkaloids, of quinine. Mm-hmm. We knew the constitution, but we didn't know it has four asymmetric carbon atoms, and that means 16 possible 2-4 stereoisomers.
Yes.
But quinine, one of them, which has antimalarial activity, is one of these 16, and you have to know when you like to talk about that, which one is that.
Yes.
So yes. You need some symbols, some mm-hmm. language, mm-hmm. and so that was one. And then if you want to determine the structure, you have to know, to have methods, to determine the special, at that time, the X-ray analysis, and especially, was not so developed. It could be used only in very few cases with success. It was very tedious, so there were chemical methods we had to develop to be able to say something about the spatial, about the configuration mm-hmm. of this spatial distribution of the atoms, and that all we slowly developed part by part. Mm-hmm. So if you read this laudatio, you see that it is not something very special. It is in general about stereochemistry of molecules and reactions. We did both, but on a relatively broad basis. We were not the only people, of course. There were many others. But perhaps we made a little bigger impression than the other. It's a matter of good luck.
Well, you have a very interesting story about how you got together with Kahn and Ingold in Manchester.
Yes.
Would you care to tell me?
Well, you know, it was just about this language, how to speak about this. Mm-hmm. How to specify a certain thing about you want to speak about.
Yes.
And it was for the carbohydrates, it was such a, I would say, parochial solution, just for carbohydrates, mm-hmm. which was developed by one of the greatest chemists of all times, Emil Fischer.
Yes.
But that was very imperfect. When you applied that on alkaloids and so on, you came very very soon into great difficulties and mm-hmm. controversies. So Kahn was editor of the Chemical Society journals, and Ingold was the president of the society at that time.
Yes.
And they had, of course, problems, because all this, when the people published, the nomenclature or the symbols were all controversial, so editor wanted to put it into a good order. So he asked Ingold what to do, and Ingold suggested something. in 51, when the people were really hopeless, frustrated about the possibilities. So they suggested something, but their suggestion was not perfect, I would say. So it was a meeting of the American, of the English Chemical Society in Manchester.
Excuse me, was that the sequence rule you're talking about?
Yeah, we are now talking about. Yeah, they suggested a so-called
sequence rule. Yes, which is still applied.
Yes, but not in the same way as they suggested. Yes. So when we were in Manchester after the meeting, which was very successful, we had a symposium on dynamic stereochemistry, which I was helping to organize. And then we, ICI, Imperial Chemical Industries, organized a ball, Octagon House in Blakely, near Manchester. And everybody danced, but Ingold, Kahn, and myself, we all three didn't dance. We were no dancers. So we drank beer and discussed chemistry. And they asked me, what do I think about their proposal? And I said, terrible. Terrible. No, we will make now a bigger mess than it was. It is already now, that we have now.
What was wrong with their...
And they, instead of sending me to hell, were kind English gentlemen, say, why don't we write a... I explained them why.
Yes.
They say, why don't we write a paper for them? And I immediately accepted. So then we met many, many times. I spent quite a lot of time for flying to London, and they came also to Switzerland, and we met somewhere else. And finally, we put down the principles, you know. We had to think, you know, how a good system should can be constructed. And then we were very soon more or less satisfied with our principles. But then the details had to be developed. And so we published them in 56, I think, our first paper in Experientia together, where the fundamentals, the basic principles of this, what they call now CIP system, were laid down. And then that system was accepted by Professor Richter at Beilstein, and they used the system to specify about 150,000 of compounds which they had in Beilstein. We would never do anything like that, but they had to do it.
Yes.
And they found certain smaller, in principle, it was good, but there were smaller difficulties with the system. So we had to prune it, to improve it. And we did it for many, for several years, for about 10 years. And in 66 we published a second paper. And that was the last paper, together with Kahn and Ingold. And in this paper we considered all what all the things which were found by Beilstein. We called it Beilstein test.
I see. So you used the actual classification to improve the system.
The basic principles remained the same, but the applications had to be in some way more correctly or more exactly. And then we published now with Professor Helmsen a third paper in which we still, when we wanted to apply the system to computers, so that the computers, but we found again that computers don't understand us sometimes.
So we had to improve. That's another test, isn't it? That's the computer test.
Yeah, and we have it now again. Beilstein editors tested again, and they found again small difficulties. We will have to publish a fourth paper. And Chemical Abstracts also use them. I've been visiting Chemical Abstracts recently. They used CIP system on 1,600,000 compounds. They have now in so-called Chemical Abstracts Online service, service online, they have registered 6,600,000 compounds, of which 1,600,000 compounds were specified by CIPC.
Mm-hmm. So that's optically active compounds.
Optically active or not or optically active, stereoisomers.
Stereoisomers, yes. Well, CIP, of course, stands for Cahn-Ingold-Prelog. Yeah, we still call it the RNS system.
But you know, it doesn't only use RNS,
no,
but
no,
it uses also
I'm
P
aware
and
of that
M
now.
And
U and L.
And all kinds of
yes,
other things.
It's getting
so we think that,
complicated.
Of course, for students, it is still RNS
still,
is important.
Yes, that's all they can cope with.
They all can
right.
And for
right.
most practical purposes.
Right.
But it has to be a very general system which will not fail in really what we want. We want to make it so perfect that it can be used. It can be used on every so-called stereogenic unit, mm-hmm. A unit which is the reason for stereoisomerism. And that's of course not easy. If you think about all possibilities you have, it's not so easy.
Yes, like helices and
all kinds of
just
other
deal
things,
with asymmetric centers,
conformations,
asymmetric
chiral conformations,
yeah,
stabilized
yeah. conformations.
Yeah.
That's
so
where you were also pioneering in
yeah, we were among
including
the first
conformations.
You know. Yes.
Into stereo. The stereochemical system.
Yeah, yes, indeed.
So
we can specify conformations.
I see,
and,
yes.
And then you had more or less also to define many concepts which were not very exactly defined in stereochemistry. Mm-hmm. What is a configuration? What
yes,
is a conformation?
Yes.
Which isomers are conformational? Mm-hmm. Which are configurational, and so on, and so on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they were usages which certainly were developed, you know, pragmatically. That means that was a case, and the concepts were developed for a very special case. Mm-hmm. Then it was used for some other cases. And whether either rightly or unrightly, and so a certain organizational order had to be developed in all these concepts, usages, and so on. And we tried to contribute something to that. Mm-hmm. And it seems that the people needed that. Mm-hmm. I think Confucius said, if I would become an emperor of China, I would first give the words the right sense, because if the words don't have the right sense, laws can't be written. And if the laws are not clear, the justice can be done. And if the justice is not there, the people become restless. They become restless. And then if the people are restless, then empire is in danger. So the first thing is for a politician to give
the right
word the right meaning.
Yes, indeed.
And so it is also in every science, I think. It's very important that the words, that we understand each other very
exactly.
well.
Exactly, yes.
And we tried also to do, and because most people who are very active, they don't care. They think that everybody will understand them anyway, and that it's more important to make discoveries than to clean the language. We are, in a certain way, I am not very proud of it, we are the linguists of science.
Yes, well, you seem to be also very mathematically oriented in your approach.
Not very much. I learned all mathematics I learned as an amateur.
You did?
I never had a good formal education.
But I get the feeling that you approach it in the sense as, say, Wanthoff approached it, which was novel then, and he approached stereochemistry from a mathematical point.
I don't think that all this older chemists knew any mathematics in the modern sense. They
maybe,
did it more instinctively, you know. They did it more instinctively. I don't think that Van't Hoff, for example, was a mathematician.
No, he was not a mathematician.
But he had a certain intuition. And more. Now it was also a small problem to use elementary mathematics, elementary geometry,
mm-hmm.
On the very elementary level,
yes.
To express certain things or to mm-hmm. correct certain things. But I had to learn my mathematics all as an autodidact. How do you say?
Autodidactic. Yes. Self-taught.
Self-taught.
In simpler terms.
Yes. I discussed it sometimes with colleagues
mm-hmm.
who are experts, but they are mostly not interested in the problems.
Not in geometry.
Of organic chemistry. They are too simple for them.
Yes.
The general things are so simple that they are not interested. And the specific things, they are not also interested because they are too specific and they don't know enough chemistry to be interested in this. Small specific problems.
Right. Well, you had some very famous predecessors who were also dealing with stereochemistry at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology. Was there any influence? Wislicenus, Victor Meyer?
You see,
or was that just.
It's very interesting that, as you very probably know, I had many, many very famous predecessors.
Huh? Yes, they all got the Nobel Prize.
The first professor here was Staedeler, who was uh-huh. not so famous. But then his successor was Wislicenus. Huh?
Yes.
And Wislicenus was one of the founders of stereochemistry.
Yes.
His successor was Hantzsch, huh? Who was mm-hmm. also one of the founders of stereochemistry and of physical organic chemistry. His pupil was, for example, Werner, who was then professor at the university and the founder of coordination chemistry. The successor of Hantzsch was Bamberger, who unfortunately was a relatively short time professor. He had an accident and lost completely his memory, so he had to retire at a very early age. His successor was Würstetter, who was then Nobel Prize winner, and his successor was Staudinger, who was also later a Nobel Prize winner. His successor was Kuhn, and successor of Kuhn was Ruzicka. So it's I'm the fifth.
Did Kuhn won the Nobel Prize also?
Kuhn was Nobel Prize.
And
winner.
Ruzicka
Ruzicka.
And you.
And so we are five in a row. Hmm? It's not so often that at a certain laboratory or a certain institution you have a continuous row of five Nobel Prize. We hope that this will continue.
So when did you learn about the Nobel Prize? How did it get to you, the message?
Oh,
that
very easy.
I got a phone
at about 1:30 from the radio.
Uh-huh. From the radio?
Yeah.
Oh.
On the broadcast.
Yes. They heard it first.
They heard it first.
They always do.
I didn't have the slightest idea, you know. And after that, the second one was the president of our city,
uh-huh.
Dr. Widmer, was the second who gratulated me. I don't know how he knew. And then, of course, many other people. And the message from Stockholm came much later.
Mm-hmm.
I got a telegram from Stockholm then, of course. Well, you see, I was relatively old. Huh?
You were just retired?
I was 69, but it was 1 year before my retirement.
Before retirement. But you were still active, you were teaching.
Yes, I was teaching and giving courses.
Mm-hmm.
And
so how did your students react?
Oh, well, you see, in Switzerland we don't make a great fuss. I came here. Hmm?
Yes.
After that, it was after lunch, you know.
Uh-huh.
I didn't hurry, I took a streetcar.
Uh-huh.
And they didn't expect me. They thought, you know, that I would take at least a taxi cab.
Yes, indeed, you deserved
it. Here in this lobby, you know, everything was full of students and colleagues, you know, who had already prepared some champagne. And,
I think
like
that's
and
quite nice.
We We had a small celebration here, but it was nothing. You see, we don't do much fuss in Switzerland about these things, you know, because it's not so rare, let us say, just in our case, yes, as it's perhaps in some other places.
A little spoiled.
People are a little spoiled. And, I think it's very nice that in Switzerland they are not heroes worshipper. We are a democratic country, you know.
That's true.
Well, they knew we had Professor Karrer and Professor Werner at the university, also two Nobel Prize winners in a row, and so on. But well, nobody would care about them, you know. They were just normal citizens. Well, when you get the Nobel Prize, you get into newspapers and so on, but only for very few days.
You get interviewed.
You will get interviewed, but not so much.
No, not in Switzerland.
Not in Switzerland. No. The people don't make quite. Don't make much. That's very pleasant, I must confess.
Yes. Well, in science, maybe it's not so.
Literature, peace is much more popular.
Yes, and especially then in the movie industry, if you win an Oscar, that's a different story. Your teaching here at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology, did you teach the organic chemistry like your predecessor?
Oh yes, during Kruzička times,
I gave the
elementary organic chemistry.
That's 1, 2, and 3 or what?
1 and 2 by that time.
There
were two semesters, winter and summer semester, and there were two organic chemistries.
I see, two organic chemistries.
Two courses.
And how many students did you have about on an
average? We had already about 100 students in chemistry department, and they were rather few in the natural sciences department.
Yes.
So we had about 120 and so on in a lecture room. All the PhD candidates came to hear it a second time or something like that, especially during Kruzička's time. I gave it for about 16 years.
16?
The first course and the second course in organic chemistry. Then I had more colleagues who shared this difficult job, you know. I had to give courses every morning from 8 to 9, from Monday to Saturday, including, and also we had some seminars in the afternoon, so I had to examine practically everybody for several years.
That's a heavy load.
Dozen of years,
but you're teaching assistants for your laboratories.
The laboratory
for
work was practically completely in the hands of some younger colleagues.
Yes.
So I didn't care very much.
So
and that was well organized, but I gave the main courses.
But there are no tests? Are you still on the same system that there were no tests?
Yeah, we have now it's much more complicated. We have instead of we had different types of organic chemistry from different type of students. Professor Ružička and myself, we gave courses for pharmaceutical students, for chemistry students, from natural science.
Individually students. Or
no,
mixed
no,
together?
All of them were in one lecture.
In one lecture, one basic lecture.
And that's all now specialized, you know. We give a special lecture for biochemistry students and special lectures for pharmaceutical students
and so on.
And we have now about different possible combinations. There are about 4 organic chemistry now, instead of 2.
It's
taught in 4 during 4 semesters.
Yes,
I see. So it changed. I even don't know exactly what they do now.
Did you use a textbook, or did you also just give a lecture that you prepared?
No, I tried to prepare.
In
57? Yes, when Ružička was 70, he retired in October, on October 1st, and I was appointed chairman of the laboratory.
Yes.
And as I mentioned that in one of these lectures, by becoming chairman, I reached the level of my incompetence.
Well, huh? I doubt that, but that's what you said.
That means, and I tried to step down.
Did you not like it? Did you not like the administrative?
I didn't like it. I had really already Professor Ruzicka organized it in such a way that we had an administrator here, which was a Dr. Engel, Bruno Engel, who took care about all kind of administrative duties, for example, buying apparatus, mm-hmm. chemicals, mm-hmm. organizing everything, and well, he committed suicide, unfortunately, after a few years. I was satisfied, you know, when I didn't have to sign bills and to control bills and so on. But for some unknown reason, he committed suicide, finally. And so I was left more or less... he was very good. So we couldn't replace him because everybody we would put on his place would be judged by the standards he had set down. So finally I found that I have to do something about it. I dislike it. It's very time consuming, you know, and if you are conscientious, especially, you know, because it was a place with about 200 people, that means staff, PhD candidates, postdoctorals, technicians, and so on. And when you have 200 people, to be a boss of 200 people, you, in some way, you meet statistics. Perhaps not fully, but if there is one or two thieves in 100 people, you will have your thieves. You will have all kinds, you will have your fires. You will have, and then you have to meet police, you have to meet firemen, you may,
health,
many other
health
things.
Rules,
health rules. And so on. Even now, it became, during this time,
very
it became
complex,
always more and more complicated.
Yes, yes,
and
yes.
The responsibility, you know, the mm-hmm. people didn't care, but now they always say the chairman is responsible, huh?
Yes.
For everything what happened. So I dislike that very much. And so we then organized a kind of collegial chairmanship that every year we changed. In between, I achieved that we increased the number of full professors to 8. We had, at a certain moment, first we had 3 professors, and then always more and more, and finally we had about 8 full professors. So we decided that every year another one will be the chairman.
I see.
But the big decisions we will make all together.
Yes.
We will talk to each other so long as we don't agree. It was sometimes not so easy. And I shall be excluded from this chairmanship because of my great merits before. And so I was not chairman for a number of years. Before I retired. I was just then one more time
chairman or not?
No. After I it was, I think, in 65.
I see. And you retired in...
And I retired in 76. So for 11 years I was more or less one primus inter pares, or the oldest, they called me der Dorf Ältest.
That's what I read, that you won the Roger Adams Award in the United States and American Chemical Society, and I had saw a little paper clipping where they said that they call you the Dorf Ältest.
The oldest man in the village.
Yes, I found the elder Dorf.
Yeah.
Of the village.
That is, so it worked well so far, especially, you know, we had a very able people who got offers from all kinds of foreign universities, for example, from Harvard, several of them, and from
others. Who were the most prominent people?
Eschenmoser, Arrigoni got offers from Harvard, Jack Danitz got offers from Yale, from Cornell. Oh, they were all associate professors at that time.
I see. So,
so first I managed to get them promoted to full professorships. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, even that perhaps, if they would be always working, so to say, under a chairman.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
They would perhaps accept this position where they would be independent.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And by organizing that collegial chairmanship, that means all of them are equal. There is no, everybody is a chairman only for a year.
Yes.
They don't feel, you know, like be in a dependent position.
That's not very important.
Very important, yes. You know, because some of them like to be independent. So I think they would be tempted by an offer in which they would say, well, you will become yourself, you will be a chairman, you can organize things as you like. Always such a group, you have always to consider your colleagues, you know, even in sharing the apparatus, the money and so on, you always have, and especially if it would be a chairman who would make all important decisions by himself,
yes, yes.
They would feel perhaps easier to be themselves independent, and they would leave Zurich, and
yes,
by
yes.
organizing that, I managed to keep them all together. We lost only Professor Heilbronner, who moved to Basel to become professor of physical chemistry at Basel. But all the other
states... Well, that was very good strategy. It was just the opposite of what Professor Ruschitzka did.
I was the first so-called personal full professor.
Mm-hmm.
It was a custom here at our school.
Yes.
That it was one chair and one full professor. That means, and we started, I was really the first, so far as I know, perhaps at physics department it was another one, so-called personal full professor.
In addition to him?
In addition to, he was the chairman,
yes.
But I was full professor.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And then I was his successor, and first I had two associate professors,
mm-hmm.
and after that we promoted, and then we added few of associate professors more, and then they got such tempting offers, and that was the reason that they were promoted to full professors, and finally we ended up with 8 full professors. When we had this rotating chairmanship, there were already 8 equivalent full professors.
Yes.
And we lost only one of them to Basel, and that was not so bad, but we didn't lose anybody to Cornell or to Harvard.
Big university in the United States. Are you well funded? How's the funding for research? Does it come partly from industry or from
first we got always quite a reasonable amount of money from the school for teaching and research. But then we were supported, Ruschitzka organized that very well because his work was interesting. He was supported strongly by industry, and I continued that.
That was Siba Geigy?
That was Siba at that time, named
Siba. Yes.
Siba. And then Siba Geigy more or less merged. No, we get less from the others.
Siba Geigy.
It was very difficult to work with several firms.
Mm-hmm.
So finally I was already on the board of Siba, and then later when they merged with Geigy on the board of Siba, or Geigy, what in United States they would call board of directors, which is called Verwaltung.
Yes, yes, and that did not constitute a conflict of interest in any way, or?
No, we tried to behave in such a way that there was not a conflict. Not everybody agreed
not
or didn't like. No. We that was always our principle, that we shouldn't work on problems which are more or less given to us by industry.
I see.
We didn't have any. They didn't say we are interested in that and that,
mm-hmm.
and you should work on that and that.
Mm-hmm.
We always worked what we wanted,
we said
if something practical should come out of our work, of course the firm which supported us will have the priority to use it. It's a very complicated. It needs quite a lot of tact and
understanding
and so on. At that time it was possible. Today it's much more difficult.
It's more difficult.
But we had then the Swiss Science Foundation appeared and was organized, and quite a lot of money is now given to the institute. Already I myself got quite a lot of money through Swiss Science Foundation,
yes,
which is like National Science Foundation in the United States. It is a semi-official organization which supports research, and you have to more or less to make a project, and the support is only temporary. So you have always to make new projects and write reports and proposals and so on. But that's like in United States.
Yes.
We have the great advantage compared with United States that we don't pay any overhead to our school. That means if you have a grant from an institution like National Science Foundation or a National Institute of Health in the United States, a great part of that goes to the school as the so-called overhead.
Mm-hmm.
That means school takes a part of this money to run the administration
and even
teaching, and that's not here. So we get we get the money from these institutions, either industry or from the National Science Foundation. We can use this money without paying any overheads. So, but we are still supported by industry.
But you did develop some products, like I'm thinking of rifamine.
Rifamycin.
Right,
that really, yes.
Commercially.
You see, we were interested in structures, and industry is interested in the biological activity.
Yes.
They really can use a product without knowing anything about structure.
Mm-hmm.
But they can improve the product by knowing structure. They can, if they know the structure, they can predict certain things which they couldn't know.
Molecular modification.
So they are interested in structure. And at that time, they didn't have, it was more difficult, opportunity to determine the structure in their own laboratories. Or that was too expensive for them. So what we did for them, we did the structures. And on the basis of these structures, then they developed it.
Right.
But they really, in some way, it's a very nice cooperation, because there are different interests, but which go parallelly.
Right.
That means we were interested how the molecules like. They need this structure to do some chemical work or to know about some properties of these compounds which they use biologically. But they did also all biological work for us, which is sometimes also necessary during the isolation and purification and so on. So it was very nice. We had also very nice cooperation with our microbiological research, so-called special botany department under Professor Goyman, who helped us in isolation of microbes which we used for our cultures. So they were also supported by industry, so it was a triangle: industry, microbiology, and organic. And each of these groups did his own part of the job, and that was it doesn't work anymore so well as it worked in our times, because everything was smaller, and now
and
so many
personal.
People do are competing in this field.
Yeah.
And
research is so costly now, isn't it?
Research is more, instrumentation is more. You see, I mentioned in some of these lectures and in some historical surveys, it is the chemistry changed by introduction of the physical methods so much as the art of war changed through invention of firearms. That means in old days they have been people very strong physically and very shrewd and so on, and they became heroes. You know, if you have a good gun, even a very weak man can kill the greatest hero behind the corner, you know, standing behind the corner, and so on. So today, but at the same time, you know, all these arms, when you had just a musket or a bow, and it was very cheap, and everybody could make it himself, you know, and so on, you know.
Yes.
By all these arms, you know, everything became much more research, you know. The cost of research increased by a factor which is something between 10 and 100.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on
yes.
that. And that, of course, the result of that is that the people who give money and who are very often not competent ask themselves what this money is used for.
So much.
They want so much, and mm-hmm. is it used properly?
Yes, sure.
And so on. And that that makes the whole thing much more complicated.
Right.
Because it's very difficult for these incompetent people to make their mind, especially if they are not too clever. So they want always more and more detailed reports, more and more detailed projects. And
they
research,
if
they don't really understand, they have to ask experts. Experts must be, if they are good, you know, they could do something better than, for example, write a report about a very bad project. The man who wrote a bad project will more or less fight. And they have to be very careful what they say and so on. So it is it's much more complicated, the whole thing. So I lived during the very good times. By the way, we owe very much to Russians. When the Sputnik, that was in 1957, came out, then the Americans decided that they have to spend some money for science, to support science, and Switzerland also. So it was very easy for me to get the necessary funds. We could do whatever we could justify. We never had a lack of money. And now it's not anymore so. Because the money is always more and more tight, and the research is always more and more expensive.
So you really actually lived in a period of great transition in the 50s from this simple classical approach to the modern approach.
My predecessor said to Professor Scherer, who was a professor of physics,
I
you remember,
yes,
Professor,
I remember
Scherer,
Professor Scherer,
what we need from physicists are stents, nothing else.
Are what?
Stents. No stative.
Oh no, ring stents.
Yeah, but that's changed.
Yes, and it's not true anymore. Indeed.
Not true anymore.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Could you also briefly tell me something about your relationship with the United States scientists? You have been on so many guest lectures
at the same time, you know, during my time, you know, I met a lot of people.
Who are the people you met?
Oh, there is
dozens. Could you name a few? That would be kind of tied together.
You know, the whole group at Harvard was always very friendly. We had that. But also the group that was all Professor Woodward, of course, Professor. I don't know which order, you know, there are now so many.
And
they are younger.
It doesn't matter. Younger.
Professor Westheimer, let us say,
Westheimer,
of the older. Professor Kistiakowski at Harvard, of the older. We knew very well people at Urbana, Illinois, which was for some time a center. That was the senior of them was Adams, you know.
Yes, that's what I wanted
colleagues,
to ask you.
Adams was a great friend of Ruzicka and continued to be a great friend of myself, you know.
Did he work on high-membered rings, large rings?
Not so much. He did few of them. Yeah,
there
he wrote,
some connection
no, but he worked
you
also on
Adams.
Natural compounds.
Natural compounds.
And so. He had a great esteem for Ruzicka, that continued. He was a very good friend. They were very good friends at Cornell, at Yale. It is so difficult to say the names, you know, because
yes,
I don't like to emphasize one because
they
are,
they are
younger and older people, you know. They always invite at Madison, Wisconsin, at
University of Berkeley,
in Los Angeles.
Did you know any of the older famous chemists like Lewis? Newton Lewis?
No. I never met him. He
you
was
never
at least
met Lewis.
A generation
How about
before.
Pauling? Linus Pauling.
Linus Pauling, I know very well. I have many, many encounters with him.
He older is a scientist.
Older scientist of older, so famous people. Many of them died. Lewis is at Harvard,
yes,
for example.
Yes. Did you have any special friends that visited you here? Or?
Oh, yes. But again, you know, it is so difficult to name one.
Yes,
of them,
because
you
have so many.
Three
so
of those,
well
there
known
are so many. And they were always friendly to us, you know, and from this lecture in Navarre, you know, that you get always through friends, you know, invitations to lecture. I have been altogether, perhaps I counted it once, more than 160 places. A great number of them
more
in the United States.
Places.
I gave lectures.
Yeah, I have the whole list here of your lectures.
But these are only named lectures, you know. These are only lectures which are a certain kind of honor. But I have been invited to many meetings of the Chemical Society. I have been invited to many symposia and so on, you know. That's not mentioned here.
Yes, I see.
And if I think, you know, how bad my English is, I wonder.
It's not bad at all. not after having spoken in English for 2 hours. It couldn't be bad. I met you in Atlantic City at the Stereochemical Symposium of the American Chemical Society.
I re-met
you.
Yeah, I remember that occasion very well. It was a big meeting of the American Chemical Society,
right. And to come to a conclusion gradually, first of all, I see that you're still active. You have published a paper on chromatography, separation of enantiomers,
just recently. That's now my hobby, liquid separation. Because that was a field which was not...
Thin layer chromatography, liquid, or high pressure
only,
liquid?
Only liquid liquid.
Yeah. Liquid.
What they say, high pressure liquid. Means liquid solid, you know, really.
You
have a column, you know, of a solid.
Right.
But that was well developed, but just liquid-liquid extraction, you know, because you don't expect that you will get a high resolution.
Mm-hmm.
And you have either to use an ionophore, and we are interested in this field because liquid membranes play a great role in biology,
mm-hmm.
and liquid membranes which will separate enantiomers, which will react to one of the enantiomers biologically active, a biogenic amine or something like that, are interesting from the biological standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
So we would like more or less to study certain simple systems where the situation is clearer than in a complicated biological
like
system
amines.
As a kind of models, like of models for more complicated biological membranes. And we have a cooperation with electrochemists of our laboratory, Professor Simon, you know, who is studying such liquid membranes electrochemically and their behavior electrochemically. So that's more or less the only field I'm now working experimentally. Still I have always one PhD, postdoctorate working in this field
for
with
you.
Me.
Did you write any books?
No.
But
I didn't write a textbook.
You didn't write a textbook.
I remember very early we had a Japanese visitor. It was very difficult to talk to him because he didn't speak but Japanese. But he spoke a few words of German or English. I don't remember. Anyway, at the end of his visit, he said to Ružička, "Professor Ružička, I think you better chemist than Karel." Družička was very proud, you know, of that.
And then he asked her,
why do you think that I'm a great said, you never wrote a text.
Oh.
So we decided
that's kind of paradox, isn't it?
That we shall never write a textbook.
I wrote
chapters for certain monographs and so, but I never wrote. Uh-huh. I am not very good in writing.
Well, it's the quadrilingual background, which is distracting.
It takes me quite a lot of trouble. You know, I write everything five times before mm-hmm. I publish, and even then it is imperfect.
Yes.
So to write a book, that is something horrible. The idea of writing a book is something horrible to me.
Well, you're maybe a little bit in limbo because you say you forgot your mother language, and then maybe the next language is not, you're not quite as...
Yes, you know, to write a book, you have to write. Either you have to learn a language very young, or you have to be very talented. Huh? Are you through with your
still running
tape?
I know you don't have a crystal ball, but what is your idea of the future of chemistry or chemical education or both? What you see in
chemistry? Chemistry is such a big field and so important because everything what happens in the world is connected.
This chemistry.
This chemistry. If you think some chemistry takes place and so on, to understand what's going on is so important. It's one of the most important things. Beyond the idea that you do something for the mankind, you do better living and better medicines and so on, but to understand what's going on everywhere in the world, inorganic or organic and so on, is so important.
Yes, it is.
So, we really started only. So I think...
We will never stop doing
chemistry and so on, because before we come to such complicated processes like memory, evidently memory is something chemical.
Evidently.
But we are so far of understanding that.
There's a lot to
and
do
we have too. To do lots of fundamental work, of basic work to understand that. We don't have the necessary tools to study them. Mm-hmm. But it improves every day. Of course, already I think Einstein said that we live in the time of always more and more perfect methods and more confused aims. We have always to think about what we really want to do. Mm-hmm. Because the possibilities are now terrible.
Yes, they're frightening.
If you take 100, a chain of 100 amino acids in a protein, and 20 different amino acids, you can make 10 to 130 possible combinations, and there are in the world, so far as we know, there are 10 to 87 atoms. So you and many proteins have several. Hundreds of amino acids or thousands of amino acids and so on. So the possibility now we have to know it will never be possible to make all these possible isomeric proteins of only of this small. So the possibilities in many of them you could do this method existing. If you now say I want to have 100 amino acids in a certain sequence combined to a protein, you can do it today.
Yes,
it will take you years to make it,
protein
and several very very able coworkers.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But you will never be able to make all of them. Or if you fail it by very few amino acids, it will not have an activity. Or which one of these should be done?
Shall we
spend $1 million to prepare one of these isomers, which will be nothing at the end? So these are problems. We have to be clear about the aims, what we want really to do. We can do now much more than chemists be ever able to do. These existing methods, and we improve them every day, make them easier, faster, and so on.
Professor Prelog, before we conclude the interview, I would like to ask you if you have any letters, papers, manuscripts on file. Where are your papers going? Are you collecting, putting together your papers?
Unfortunately, I would say I have too much of that.
Yes.
And it would be very difficult to sort out what is important, what is important, what is not important. It would be just a very difficult task. I think what I shall keep is a correspondence with Kahn, Ingold, and other people contributed to the CIP system.
So where are these papers located? Where do you keep these? Right at the institution?
I have them now here, but I shall then put all these things together and perhaps let it to the archive of, to the library of the Federal Institute of Technology, who do quite a good job collecting correspondence papers of some of the members of the faculty. For example, they will keep all the important correspondence which Ružička left. They have a special place where they keep the correspondence and manuscripts of Thomas Mann, for example, who was also a kind of professor here at the Federal Institute during his last years.
I see.
They have also the correspondence of Carl Gustav Jung, and some other of the important members of the faculty. So I think they do it professionally, I think, and very well. They make indexes of that and so on. But I don't think I have so many letters. Some of them, of course, are more important than the others. But I think it would be a formidable task to more or less to store that and to select them.
Yes, but they will go to the archives of the Swiss
Federal
Institute
of Technology.
No, I think
that I will, that most of the correspondence I will not keep.
Just what's relevant to your scientific, your scientific
very,
correspondence.
Very relevant.
Right, your scientific.
Because other way. Very soon, even Federal Institute of Technology wouldn't have
will
enough
run
space.
Out of space.
Would run out of space, like they do with patent literature.
Yes, unless they put it on microfilm. Well, Professor Prelog, I would really like to thank you for the interview you gave me, and you have given me so much interesting information about your life and about your relationship with your work and with the other scientists in America, and it has been a great experience, and I'd like to thank you very much.